Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold. We're at episode number 68 now for the middle of October. As a reminder, the opinions are our own. I am Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods.
And these opinions are our own. They don't belong to JBJS or the editorial board or anyone on the board of JBJS. This episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. Go on to the website, get your CME and your Learn On, get a comprehensive look at all different parts of orthopedics through JBJS, and you will not be disappointed by the fantastic content there. Without further ado, we're going to start with top of the pile, what's new in shoulder and elbow surgery by Harrison et al., and it's permanently free. There's also readability analysis of Spanish language patient-reported outcome measures in orthopedic surgery by Garavito. There's also clinical practice guidelines to support capacity building and orthopedic surgical outreach and international consensus building approach by Welch. What's important? Quote, making it, quote, an orthopedic surgery residency as an international medical graduate. This is by Merkley. As a shout out, this is permanent free, and he is one of the residents that I work with, and it's fantastic that he put his experience out there. In the Alpha Angle by Ikitari, and talking about the hip there. We're going to start with the headlines. Why don't you take it away with clinical outcomes following operative and non-operative management of odontoid fractures among elderly individuals with dementia by Schoenfeld et al., 30 days free.
Yeah, that name kind of sounds familiar.
Good name, let me tell you.
Yeah. So I was conflicted as to whether or not to cover this, but then it was selected as an editor's pick. So I thought it was useful to present. And I think this paradigm that we're exploring here, which is really looking at the effects of dementia on outcomes for patients with orthopedic injuries, is really something that's very important. And it ties into a lot of work that we've done within the Harvard MGB system and some of the things that you've done and some of the things that I've done for a number of conditions for which we are talking about life-threatening or life-impacting conditions that alter the arc of a patient's life, be they surgical site infections after joint replacement or epidural abscess or spinal metastases or some type of fracture in patients who are already frail, who may also have serious medical comorbidities. And there is a question about what more surgery is going to do to these patients and for these patients. And I think that's an important question and one that's going to increasingly challenge us as a field as the U.S. and global demographic really continues to age. And I think this is especially important for patients with dementia because they are not only a group that is growing because of these many other characteristics that we already discussed, but it's one that really is a model for the intersection between already having some baseline impairment and then being confronted with some of these conditions through a fall or some other type of injury that then are materially altering the arc of their already impacted lives. And what do we do to provide the best type of care for these patients? This study was supported by the NIH. This is part of the Decades Grant, which is a grant that's looking at helping patients and their family members, patients living with dementia and their family members, make decisions around surgical care. And sometimes that may be surgical care in the setting of an elective intervention, and sometimes it may be in the setting of something that's more urgent or emergent, such as hip fractures and odontoid fractures, which of course are increasingly recognized as somewhat analogous to the hip fracture for elderly patients, but in the cervical spine, obviously. But a lot of the same paradigms, a lot of the same parameters sort of shared between those two conditions. And we previously did a decade study on hip fractures that was published in JAMA Open earlier this year. This was a study looking at the odontoid fractures and examining several important aspects of care. And that includes the decision for surgery or non-operative treatment, whereas non-operative treatment may increase the risk of aspiration, reduce mobility, other attendant complications, such as venous thromboembolic disease. And then on the other face of the coin is surgical intervention. Well, what if that drives more intense procedures because of a failure, or then the patients are in the ICU, or they're prolonged intubated, or they need a gastric feeding tube, or they end up in hospice after the surgery. It's a lot of important considerations here to honor these patients, to honor wishes that they may have regarding preferential decisions around treatment, operative versus non-operative, end-of-life care. They all factor into this. So we wanted to look at this in a comprehensive way in a cohort that would have a reasonable number of patients with a national reach and scope and longitudinal follow-up. And that was really best performed using Medicare claims data. So we're talking about, you know, the recent past, patients who were treated in 2017, 2018. We included over 1,000 patients. And to account for, in a secondary analysis, to account for selection and indication bias, we used inverse probability of treatment weighting. And what we found was that the surgical cohort, which represented about 1 in 5 patients, those treated surgically had a lower hazard of mortality. They did have a higher likelihood of delirium, which is a known complication following surgery in this cohort and has been shown in many other studies. And ultimately, patients who did have surgical intervention for odontoid fractures, they did have improved survivability, and they did not have increased risk of follow-on intensive interventions. And that's important for understanding that it's not just about survival, but it's also quality of life in that context. So ultimately, our results convey that for individuals with dementia who have a type 2 odontoid fracture, surgical intervention may confer survival benefit, optimizing chances for functional recovery, return to pre-injury environments of care, including patients' home, which is also incredibly important in this setting. And although there is a modest increase in likelihood of delirium, this did not result in further follow-on effects. There was a lower rate of hospice admission without concomitant increase in intensive interventions, as I mentioned. So we think this is useful for discussing care goals, optimal treatment strategy, and ultimately, it has to be a case-by-case decision with the patient, their family members, and take into account care goals. But in those individuals with life care goals that include life prolongation and maximizing quality of life, it would indicate that a surgical procedure is a reasonable choice to make in this setting. And I think that's good information for the community and important information for patients, providers, both medical and surgical, as well as families.
I think this work is incredibly impactful. I love how you looked at it from more than just the actual fracture itself and patient impact. So, you know, normally people like control for dementia, but here you're actually looking at dementia and comparing them between patients. So, phenomenal work. I have nothing bad to say about it, and I won't put it on hold.
Important, you know, sneak peek here and further research. This is in the urgent setting. When we're talking about elective procedures, different consideration.
Great point. Good point. Agreed. All right. Well, thanks for that. I'm going to talk about something a little bit different. We're switching to the other end of the age spectrum now and talking about accuracy of 4 different methods for estimation of remaining growth and timing of epiphysesis. This is by Breen et al. We know that there are multiple methods for calculating remaining growth in children and the timing of permanent epiphysesis in those of leg length discrepancies. The most common 4 methods are Green-Anderson, White-Milenaus, Mosley straight line graph, and multiplier methods. The purpose of the study was to identify the most accurate method with the use of bone age or chronological age, and to evaluate the importance of including the reduced growth rate of the short leg or the inhibition side compared with the long leg when estimating the leg length discrepancy at maturity. The authors identified 269 patients who were managed with epiphysesis with the use of a percutaneous technique, and this is between 1992 and 2019. Of these, 257 patients were followed until skeletal maturity, but there were only 191 patients included. They had to have 2 leg length examinations with simultaneous bone age assessments, but the last examination performed less than 6 months before surgery. Patients were examined within 3 months of surgery, were then compared to patients who were examined within 6 months of surgery to see if there was a difference. Patients were excluded if they'd undergone other surgical procedures involving the lower extremity. The patients were 10 to 17 years of age, and they underwent the surgical closure of the growth plate. And these were identified from a hospital registry, so a local hospital registry. Patients had at least these two leg length examinations, and the accuracy of each method was calculated as the mean absolute prediction error, which is the predicted leg length minus the actual leg length at maturity for the short leg, the long leg, and the limb length difference. And comparisons were made among the four methods and among calculations made with chronological age versus bone age and those made with looking at the short leg versus the long leg. The study population consisted of a majority of boys. There was 114 boys versus 77 girls. And the majority of patients underwent operative management within 3 months after the last bone age assessment. There found that of the four methods, the white melanios method with the use of bone age and a fixed inhibition rate was the most accurate method, with a prediction error of 1.5 plus or minus 1.5 centimeters, which is then zero if you go to the minus side, for the short leg, and 1.0 plus or minus 1.2 centimeters for the long leg, and 0.7 plus or minus 0.7 centimeters for the limb length discrepancy. They did pairwise comparisons of short leg length and limb length discrepancy according to the white, melanos, and other methods, and to show that they were significantly different, showing that the white melanos system or method was better. The calculated inhibition rate did not increase accuracy. So the take-home message in this pretty concise study, I would say, you know, looking at radiographic analyses, one thing I like about trying to standardize an approach, especially to something like epiphydesis, is that for future research, if everyone's using the same method, you can compare apples to apples opposed to apples to oranges. And finding out the accuracy of that is actually interesting and, you know, reduces the variability of this study as well as future studies as well. So their take-home message was the only one method of evaluation. So I do like that looking at this patient age group.
Yes, interesting study, some valuable insights. I would say the one thing is that, you know, they have slightly under 200 children. Everything was really assessed in a standardized way, which is good. But yeah, I'm just concerned that there may be some restricted variation. You know, ideally, you'd want to have adequate representation across the entire universe of possible iterations in this case. So they talked about the short limb, the long limb, and then the limb length discrepancy. So you'd want to have, you know, very mild cases, very severe cases, really just having adequate numbers across the entire possible universe, which to my mind probably suggests a multi-center type of initiative. And I just think 191 children is probably not enough. I'm just surmising here. I think you're going to have like a lot of, if you assume a normal distribution, you're probably getting a lot of that population that's in the middle and not so much on the extremes. And that's where these kinds of scoring methods and assessment systems actually tend to fail. They don't fail in most common iterations. They fail in the harder, the more challenging predictions, which is either the very severe or the not so severe.
Totally agree. So more patients can't hurt to have it. This is, you know, published in literature now. For those of you who do epiphydesis, I would recommend that you guys do this and create a multi-center study where you do have a bigger variation of patients and, you know, either validate the results or invalidate the results. So that's research for you. All right, going into our next one. Your case is on hold, paired with delayed reconstruction in multi-ligament knee injury, a retrospective propensity analysis by Holt et al. There's a commentary on it, there's a visual summary, and it's free for 30 days. There's no excuse to not check this one out. I like this study because of the great debate in when do you reconstruct a multi-ligament reconstruction. The purpose of the study was to compare early versus delayed reconstruction of patients with multi-ligament knee injuries. And the authors hypothesized that patients who underwent early reconstruction would have better outcomes than patients who underwent delayed reconstruction. Early reconstruction was defined as less than 6 weeks after injury, and delayed reconstruction was defined as 12 weeks to 2 years after the injury. Patients were excluded if they underwent reconstruction between 6 and 12 weeks after the injury, so they can allow for a true delineation between the groups. This is a retrospective cohort analysis of multi-ligament knee injury patients from 2007 to 2019, and they initiated a prospective database in January 1st, 2006. But 2007 was the first full year of follow-up, of 12-month follow-up. Patients were included if they were greater or equal to 14 years of age, had high-grade injury to two or greater knee ligaments, and underwent a reconstructive procedure with at least 1 year of follow-up. Any patients who got temporizing measures, such as a spanning X fix, were not considered to be reconstructive. And it said that the senior author did not prefer to use these or were not routinely used. Multivariable regression models with inverse probability of treatment weighing were used to compare the timing of the surgical procedures. The primary outcome was the multi-ligament quality of life questionnaire, and the secondary outcomes were manipulation under anesthesia, Kellgren-Lawrence osteoarthritis grade, knee laxity, and range of motion. Differences in characteristics between groups were balanced by performing a propensity score analysis using this approach with stabilized weights, which you can weigh into in a little bit later. The pun was intended to say way a little bit later. There were a total of 131 patients who met the inclusion criteria, with 75 patients in the early reconstruction group and 56 patients in the delayed reconstruction group. The mean time to the surgical procedure was 17.6 days in the early group compared to 260 days in the delayed reconstruction group. And my question to you here is that, are we comparing apples to apples or are we comparing apples to oranges with that big of a difference? The mean postoperative follow-up was 58 months, and the early reconstruction group compared to the delayed reconstruction group had more lateral-sided injuries, had more nerve injuries, and then higher mean Schneck class, meaning a higher injury severity. After propensity adjustment of those variables, the authors found no difference between the early and delayed reconstruction across the four domains of the multi-ligament quality of life questionnaire. Patients in the early reconstruction group had higher odds of undergoing a manipulation under anesthesia compared with delayed reconstruction group, and the adjusted odds ratio was 3.85. And patients in the early reconstruction group had less knee flexion at the most recent follow-up. If the patient had early reconstruction, they had lower Kellgren-Lawrence grade osteoarthritis compared to patients in the delayed group, and there were no differences in clinical laxity between group. The authors then also performed a sensitivity analysis for all outcomes, in which age and BMI were added as covariates within the stabilized IPTW in multivariate models, but it demonstrated no meaningful changes compared with the initial analysis that was performed, meaning the findings held strong even with the sensitivity analysis. The take-home message is that they said that early reconstruction is likely to have more incidence of manipulation under anesthesia and less knee flexion, but less likely to develop osteoarthritis in the time frame of this study. I'm concerned because I feel like those who are reconstructed early versus those who are reconstructed late are slightly different animals, such as an open injury. Sometimes patients are immobilized for a lot longer, and you know, you're not going to mobilize a patient for 280 days. So those patients are moving, have better range of motion because you can reconstruct them for a later time frame. And those patients are probably trying to be treated non-operatively initially, and then they undergo operative management later on because of, you know, either instability or persistent pain or something like that, where they feel like that undergoing a delayed reconstruction is beneficial for them. So I do like the age-old question, but I don't know if we're comparing the right populations with one another. I'd love to know your input in this.
Yes, I would agree. I think that it's challenging for me to really accept. Now, granted, this is not an area in which I work, but that a cohort of patients who had surgery between 12 weeks and 2 years is even in the same ballpark as a group that received the treatment 6 weeks after the injury. I would characterize it this way. If I would imagine, and you can jump in here as well, if we're seeing a patient in the hospital with a multi-ligament knee injury, we might say, well, you know, you're eligible for early surgery or you're eligible for late surgery. Early surgery means we're going to take care of this within the next 6 weeks. Late surgery would mean we're going to let this settle down and what, we're going to do it in 2 months, 8 weeks, 3 months, 12 weeks, even within the first 6 months. Okay, fine. I don't think we'd ever tell a patient, we're going to do this in a delayed fashion. We'll see you in 2 years, right? Like, that's just not, there has to be something else going on with patients that were delayed for 2 years.
And deal with it.
Yeah.
Sucks to be like,
come back, we'll see you in a couple years. Like, I think it's a misstep that those patients, whatever outliers they may be, were included in this. I think it should have been more reasonable, actionable time window that could have been considered. So I think that's the misstep. The question for people who are looking to use this in their practice is if you think that the covariates that they considered in the propensity score that they then used for weighting, that part is the right approach given the numbers that they have absolutely doing the weighting as opposed to a match. But does age, sex, body mass index, injury severity, dislocation, direction, and nerve injury, is that the complete universe of factors that you're going to consider? Are there other things that you would consider that are not in there? And I think, you know, in terms of the actual application of how they did the causal inference test, that's totally fine. I think they did a good job with that. I would say, I think that, you know, one of the things that really stands out to me is the increased risk of arthritis Kellgren-Lawrence score. And that's because these patients, they're evaluating from the date of surgery, not the date of injury. So when you have patients who have been sitting around for a year or 2 years longer before they get the surgery, well, then, you know, if you follow them up for 58 months, they're already 6-7 years after the surgery. Whereas the patients that had the surgery within the first 6 weeks, they're only, whatever, 3-4 years after the surgery, 5 years after the surgery. So you've got on average almost 2 extra years. They could have done something where it was like follow the patients with the early surgery for 2 extra years beyond what you're following the late surgical group. And it might be that the Kellgren-Lawrence at that point is going to end up the same in both cohorts because there's a baked in, you know, they talk about, they talk about immortal time bias. This is kind of an immortal time bias for the knee. It's used in a different way when you hear about it actually referred to in studies, but this is kind of analogous in my estimation.
Makes a lot of sense. So take this with a grain of salt. This is on hold right now. I appreciate your input on there. I like your stats background, and I learn from these method editor comments as well as I know other listeners do as well. But going on to our honorable mentions, talking about generalized joint hypermobility is associated with type A hip dysplasia in patients undergoing periacetabular osteotomy by Ping et al. The prevalence of generalized joint hypermobility is typically greater in patients with they found that the prevalence of generalized joint hypermobility was greater in patients with developmental dysplasia of the hip than in healthy controls. A higher degree of joint hypermobility was also correlated with more severe hip dysplasia. These results suggest that joint laxity, in addition to bone or cartilage factors, are important factors related to developmental dysplasia of the hip. For acute flaccid myelitis, midterm clinical course of knee extension paralysis and outcomes of nerve transfer by Doi et al. The paralysis of the lower extremity in patients with acute flaccid myelitis was similar to those of patients with poliomyelitis. However, in acute flaccid myelitis, there is spontaneous recovery of knee extension if there were signs of recovery from hip abductor paralysis up to 6 months after paralysis onset. Contralateral obturator nerve to femoral nerve transfer may enhance the recovery of knee extension and seems to be a reliable reconstruction for restoring knee extension if performed no more than 8 months after paralysis onset. What's the landscape of lumbar cartilaginous endplate microbiota and metabolites in patients with modic changes? This is by Nian et al. There's an infographic and it's permanently free. The compositions of and interactions between microbiota and metabolites in the lumbar cartilaginous endplates of patients with modic changes were evaluated in the study, and the microbiota community structure demonstrated differences in alpha and beta diversity between patients with and without modic changes. And there were abundances of 26 genera that were significantly different between the two groups. Metabolomic analysis showed that 26 metabolites were significantly different between the two groups. They really focused on the unsaturated fatty acid pathway, and it was found to be the main pathway related to these modic changes. Taliobacteriae and Microbacterium, Clostridium, Blavata, and Bifidobacterium at the genus level were linked to dysregulation of fatty acid metabolism, contributing to the pathogenesis of modic changes. That was a lot of words and definitely a lot of bacteria. So we have background pathogens that definitely affect our bodies. And finally, looking at anterior vertebral body tethering, a single center cohort with 4.3 to 7.4 years of follow-up by Hornstermeyer with an infographic, vertebral body tethering is a well-recognized non-fusion alternative for idiopathic scoliosis in patients with growth remaining. The authors performed a retrospective study of clinical and radiographic data with a mean of 5.7-year follow-up from the first 31 consecutive patients that they performed this anterior vertebral body tethering. The success rate dropped to 64% with longer follow-up as deformity measures increased, and the revision rate increased to 24% following two additional surgical revisions. Four additional suspected broken tethers were identified for a rate of 55%, with only one occurring beyond 4 years. No additional patients had a conversion to a posterior spinal fusion. So while there was less success rate over time as the deformities increased, it may indicate that because you didn't have to go to a posterior spinal fusion, there might be some longer-term survivorship with this anterior vertebral body tethering. That's it for now. We appreciate your time. Thanks for dialing in, and we look forward to having you on next time.
Yeah, check us out next time. We'll be talking about additional crazy research coming into November, getting into the end of the year. Hopefully everybody's cases are on green, but here, your case is still on hold.